Morning, welcome. Thank you all for being here. I am Michael Govan. I'm CEO and Wallace Annenberg, director of the Los Angeles County Art Museum, and I am here due to my long relationships with the artists, architects that are here, and very excited to have a conversation with them and with you. I just must say at the outset that one of our panelists, our architect David Ajay, is delayed. He came from all the way from Ghana to be with us this morning, and his plane is a little bit late, but he's going to make it, and it's going to be great. So in the meantime, let me just start by introducing Max Brown, who's the chairman of the Board of Directors of Events DC, the official convention and sports authority for the city, and our host, Max.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning, everybody. Since this is sort of a South by Southwest event, I'm a little underdressed, although it's Washington, so I still have a proper shirt and collar, but no jacket. So I am chairman of the board of Events DC. We're the official convention and sports authority for the District of Columbia. And on behalf of our board of directors, our CEO, Greg O'Dell, and Eric Moses, our managing director, I'm really, really happy to be here today to partner with the White House for the inaugural South by South Lawn. I do want to thank Eric and his team for all the work that they've done to pull this together. Eric, thank you. So as the official convention and sports authority for the nation's capital, we're so pleased to welcome all of you to Washington, D.C., to celebrate the spirit of innovation, flourishing creative economies through this first ever festival of ideas, art, and action. You know, I've been in Washington since 1985. This is really exciting. Washington's changed a lot, and this is really illustrative of that change. So this unparalleled collaboration with the White House and South by South Lawn really enables us, Events DC, to position the nation's capital and its vibrant creative economy and robust civic engagement on a global stage. At Events DC, our goals are twofold. One, generate increased visibility for DC and all of our entertainment and sports offerings in an effort to attract unique and diverse entertainment options for our nearly 20 million visitors and 700,000 residents. And two, foster economic development for our amazing residents of the city. Through our daily efforts, we remain committed to supporting the district's creative communities, as they are vital components to the continued development of our city's growing and diverse economy. In DC, we've seen how the business of creative capital acts as a catalyst for economic development, and how that landscape is vast, powerful, and continuously evolving with technology advancements and partnerships from professional to amateur ranks. I was excited to talk to a few startup companies outside on the patio. You know, 25 years ago, there may have been three or four, and I remember them when I worked for the mayor. We brought them together. It was a very small room. Now you actually need a big room to get all of our startup companies and creative companies in one place. You know, this incredible South by South Lawn mirrors the transformation that's been taking place in Washington over the last 20 years. As I like to tell people, it's a hackneyed phrase, but we're not your grandfather's Chevy anymore. We're more like a Volt or a Tesla. Our economy is a more diverse one, with technology and creativity driving jobs and economic development alongside our government partners. Events DC support for South by South Lawn also reinforces Washington, DC's efforts annually at South by Southwest, where we promote and advance our local technology and creative sectors, our innovative startup companies, and our experienced and highly educated talent pool. So with that plug, we hope that you'll come and visit us in March at Austin and see the great activations we have taking place. I want to thank again the extraordinary White House team for imagining and creating and executing the first ever South by South Lawn, convening this incredible community of talent. And importantly, I want to thank our friends and partners at the museum. I was around when this building was built because I'm old and I live right up the street. And it's great to be able to come here and with my kids and see all the visitors who are coming here. You know, the museum's a great partner for this kickoff of South by South Lawn. It's an international organization that promotes, explains, and defends free expression in this new era of digital innovation. The museum is the center for discussions on the important issues of the day. From the First Amendment rights of individuals posting online, to who is a journalist in this new age, to digital literacy, and how creativity and storytelling impact new technologies like virtual reality and journalism. The museum is leading the way on exploration of topics crucial to the success of all of us here today and in the rest of the world. I'd be remiss also if I didn't acknowledge our film and television office director, Angie Gates. Angie, good to see you, and thanks for all that you do to promote DC. So I'm excited to officially kick off the inaugural South by South Lawn breakfast panel and show everyone how we do it here in Washington, D.C. of 2016. Thank you all very much. Michael?
Thank you. Thank you, Max, for hosting us. Thank you for all you're doing here in D.C. And I just want to say how personally excited and proud I am of the White House's recognition of the importance of the arts in our world, in our society, in our nation. And that's why it's really exciting that we have with us today to lead off on that, Jane Hsu, who's the 11th chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. And she has been doing an amazing job. She is a very already accomplished person and educated. You have a BA in music, an MA in music and piano, an MA in business administration, a PhD in philanthropic studies, and you practice all of them. And you did what I did previously. You were CEO of a large cultural organization, the Kauffman Center for Performing Arts in Kansas City. You know the challenges that institutions face and what can be accomplished there. And at the NEA, partly through the 50th anniversary of the NEA initiative, and I should note LACMA, our Los Angeles County Museum of Art, celebrated our 50th the same time, so we have that in common. You created this Creativity Connects program, which is grants to arts organizations for projects that include partnerships with non-arts organizations. This happens every day, that arts are part of partnerships with the rest of the world. We know that, and you've formalized that and are doing great things there. And I have heard her speak about arts, spirit, and ideas, and about arts in the nation that she said once, with the nation's might and strength must also come heart and soul. And that has been what you've done here. So Jane Hsu, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here. We're not here really to discuss the step-by-step skills and the tools that you need to build the greatest apparatus to end all apparatuses in order to improve our lives and the lives of others, because you're going to figure out what specific tools and skills and resources that you'll need when you're ready to execute that great idea. But we really are here today to follow up on that English proverb, where there's a will, there's a way, to focus on those conditions that we need inside of us that energize us to want to be innovative, to tackle those demanding topics about which most people say it cannot be done. We're here today to talk about the challenges and the rewards of taking on those hard things, or as I like to call it, dreaming big. And this country is what it is today because of its commitment to chasing those wild dreams and pursuing innovative ideas. From the notion that we could see another galaxy through a telescope, or cure polio, or prepare food in minutes, seconds. It is in America's DNA to turn big dreams into meaningful realities. And this holds true when it comes to our arts and cultural landscape. Who would have ever dreamed that the side of a massive cliff could be sculpted into the faces of a four American presidents, or that a new musical scale with six notes instead of 12 would give us the joy of hearing jazz, blues, rock, gospel, soul, or pop music? Who would have ever guessed that a 21-year-old undergraduate could translate the results of a controversial war into a moving and healing memorial. These achievements all required that persistent passion and ambition and visionary thinking. Both James Terrell and David Ajay fully embody this spirit of dreaming big, and they know how to break into new ground and confront challenges they have spent their careers making possible through the arts, what others would deem impossible. And as an artist, the primary materials that Mr. Terrell uses are light and space. And so from these materials, he creates these large-scale physical environments that engage our senses and provoke our imagination and challenge our perceptions. James Terrell's works have been installed in 22 countries, 17 U.S. states to date, and one of his most notable works, I hope he talks about it today, is the Rodin Crater, which is located in the Painted Desert region in Arizona. Mr. Terrell carved a series of tunnels and chambers into crater walls in order to heighten our senses of earth and sky together. Mr. Ajay is the award-winning architect of Washington, D.C.'s new National Museum of African American History and Culture, and Mr. Ajay's projects range from the Rivington Place Visual Arts Center in London, the Nobel Peace Center in Norway, and his designs are not only visually stunning, but they're imbued with the meaning and context of what lies within. And so in this way, his structures also function as stories. They're critical components of a visitor's experience. We're so excited and pleased to be able to hear the insights of these two esteemed artists. And so I will turn it back now to Michael to lead us through the rest of the conversation. Thank you.
Chairman, thank you for everything you do. So I will first, I'd like to introduce Mr. Ajay in absence, and he will be here, and we have a short film, but just to say a few words about him. Many of you already know him, and I hope many of you have had a chance to visit the new Smithsonian National Museum for African American History and Culture, which is a real triumph. I actually grew up here in Washington and have watched these museums be built, the East Wing, the Hirshhorn, and now this museum, and it's very exciting. And it was particularly exciting to have this new museum built by somebody who's a friend and who I know and whose work I've followed for so long. I think all of us are very proud of him. He was born in Tanzania. His parents were from Ghana, where he's traveling from today. His father was a diplomat, which is very relevant, I think, to his understanding of global situation. He, and you'll see, has been involved in music, art, science, cities, and even furniture. His range of work is incredible. He got his MA at the Royal College of Art, and he in 2000 founded his Ajay Associates, and Jane mentioned the Nobel Peace Center, which is an amazing piece of architecture. I just recently saw his Sugar Hill development in Harlem, which is mainly for homeless, and in that space there are spaces for preschool. There's a preschool museum for children's art and storytelling. But that's the way he thinks. If it's Rivington Place, the Stephen Lawrence Center in London, he thinks about community spaces. And if you haven't, you should see the two libraries he made here in Washington. And we're going to talk about those later. He sees architecture as really a socially emancipatory art form. And he practices that in his work. A lot of public projects, a lot of projects we joke he really doesn't get paid for, or the opposite. And through his research, he has made an extensive research on architecture in Africa and published it, the first time the architecture of that continent has been really discussed at that level. He's worked everywhere from Moscow to Washington, D.C. And I think one thing that's true is that his work always does, I think as he says, binds people and places together, as this new museum does, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But just to start, I thought there's a short video just to give a sense, so he is present here, and then he will show up in a real sense.
I As an architect, I draw inspiration from a lot of things, but I have a deep interest in Africa and Africa's diaspora, so the US, wherever it may be, the sort of trajectory in history. I'm interested in it because I simply am African. I was born on the continent. I grew up in Europe, but I have a deep connection also to my where my family's from and where my roots are. And I don't see any conflict in that.
For me, what makes David's architecture stand out is that he's able to generate projects of significance and meaning, but they still have an informal quality. So they are projects that are meant to be used. These aren't monuments that are just meant to be revered. These are projects that really embrace the user, especially his public projects.
Well, I think that architecture, after all, is a translation of science into real spaces, into volumes, into physical containers that become, living environments and lived experiences. That's really the way in which we relate to architecture. But all architecture, in many ways, are abstractions that are concretized into clearly delineated forms.
David has very interestingly re-injected the idea that there is a social dimension to architecture, not in a way which is oppressive or militant, but he's reminded architects that they have a role to play. And David's been very successful, I think, at creating a language which celebrates the presence of a library, a gallery, a community centre, a place which is there for the people, which creates a sense of a public space around them.
It's a signature style that's not immediately apparent. It is by how you perceive the exterior and how that belies what goes on the interior. It's this kind of compression and expansion of space. These kind of very experiential moments that he creates in each place that I see as his signature.
I think what was important was that the atmosphere was very particular for the paintings, and that the room supported some of the ideas for that were contained within the paintings. That it was one that would be a container for the paintings, but one that would actually help to enhance the experience of looking at the paintings.
David has an exceptional sense around shifting how you can experience a space, and that's one of the reasons that I was interested in talking to him, because of the experience of the upper room. The collaboration came from being able to have a conversation, and it was really about this idea of slowing down a viewer to look at painting differently. His interest in light, and using light, and using texture and color and tone to really also change an orientation of space, these very sensual decisions in a way. These were reasons I was attracted to working with him.
And as James and I said, if he's not here, we're going to talk about him. James has worked with him as well, so we'll have some fun either way. I would like to introduce James Terrell, an artist who I have admired and been lucky enough to work with for decades. He starts on the west coast of California, born in Los Angeles, and studied psychology as an undergraduate. And I always say at a very young age, he could draw. And I always comment, he already knew how to draw, but the question is, how do we see? And he, in a sense, I think, studied that. He also went to UC Irvine and got his MA in art in 1973. But just relevant to our discussion with the chairman of the NEA, he won an NEA Individual Artist Grant in 1968. When the agency was just, or the endowment was just 3 years old. He's won way too many awards to mention, but including all of the ones you would want, including the Guggenheim Fellowship, another NEA award in 75, archive relevant. He won the MacArthur Genius Prize, and recently among these 50 awards in art and architecture, I should note, which is a something we'll talk about, the Presidential Medal in the Arts. And he also lives locally in Oxford, Maryland with his wife, Kyung. So he's also a local resident as well as living in Arizona, and we will talk about the Roden Crater Project. James Terrell has also been, for me, a teacher. His work in art is a work in light and perception. And it, very interestingly, as an artist, he did not make paintings in a traditional sense or sculpture, but even began his career making works in light and light physical, which we will talk about. And a lot of his work is about our perception. I think one thing I like to say, it's not as much about his seeing or expression, but about our seeing, and that's what he provides. So I'd like to invite James to come forward. We have a short video to show on Roden Crater, and then we'll begin the conversation. James.
As a child, I wished to touch the light of dreams and bring it before the eyes of day, to build new worlds of light as powerful as the lucid dream. When I was a child, all the houses had blackout curtains, and I took these curtains and, with a reasonably large needle, created the full map of the sky. It was wonderful to me. I pulled down the curtains and I could see the stars that were there, but you couldn't see. That idea of seeing what's beneath was what was important to me. My family was conservative Quaker, or Wilburite, and so I build Quaker meeting houses. The church meets together inside to greet the light, and they downplay the physicality or the decorative qualities of the space. There's no symbolism. They don't believe in art, they feel it's a vanity. I don't know that I believe in art, but I certainly believe in light. The history of art is a history of depicting light. And I had sort of the very American kind of direct way of deciding, let's work with light. So that rather than light being something that reveals, light itself becomes a revelation. We use light to illuminate other things. But I also wanted to emphasize the thingness of light. You don't form it like clay. You don't carve it away like wood or stone. It's more like sound, like dealing with sound. So you make an instrument that produces it the way you want. When the eye has less light, it opens. And it's not until the pupil opens, that feeling comes out of the eyes as touch. Then you're really touching with light. That's why I have many spaces you have to go into and you don't see for 10 minutes. But without focus, without image, without object, what are you left with? You can be left with actually seeing your seeing, or really feeling how you go about seeing and how you make this and create this reality with that you then live within. Often the eyes will even create form when it's not there. You know, I've even been sued by people who fell to the floor of the museum. In the Whitney show, a woman's testimony was there was this wall, I leaned against it and it wasn't there. Well, I do think you should stand up to contemporary art. We think the sky is blue. We forget to realize that actually we award it its color. So if I change your circumstance or your context of vision, then I can change the color of the sky. So those qualities of vision are like a melody to me or something. It's very sweet and delicious. I mean, I love that seeing. So this is something of taking the nature perception into nature, telling the story of how we see the sky and how our perception, our seeing, forms the sky.
There's evidence that we've been here a long time and that we had this
notion to get up into the sky, and I got a little bit of a head start by starting out with a volcano. I love the idea of coming to a site, not knowing what it was, what it was for. At Woden Crater, I'm making a pre-made ruin. I'm very fascinated by the early pyramids, and this idea of going more toward the cosmos by actually getting up into the sky. And Woden Crater is a place that is between the Earth and the cosmos.
Events and objects down into your personal lived-in space. So in making the music of the spheres played by these objects that are on fire, I want to call attention to them so that out of this sort of chaos, I make them to be the strong things that you experience and feel.
Are fixed, that we receive the phenomena of the world and that we're not a part of creating that which we behold. But we are definitely a part of creating that which we behold, and this is a kind of a gentle koan to kind of make you realize that. Now, Woden Crater now will be seen as a life's work, even though I had never intended it that way. It's sort of like your friends that never finished their doctoral thesis. Still working on it, though. It's coming. Every artist is bringing to light, like an explorer, certain parts of a continent.
You go through it, and these things are your discovery.
Every evening we unfold the light, and every morning fold it back to return the blue to the sky. This is the light that's just passing through, just beneath that usually seen. Who owns it? You who look, not to be held, but known.
That film was made last year by young filmmaker Jessica Yu for an event when Art and Film Gala, where we honored James Turrell, which followed a huge retrospective that we had in Los Angeles. Before getting to talk about Woden Crater, I wanted to just show a few pictures and focus in on some of the images you saw in the film. And talk about them a little bit by introduction, and maybe have some conversation about that. This is a work from 1966 called Afram, and you saw it in the movie. And of course, photography cannot capture this work. It is a work that is a projection of light in the corner of a room, But it's not evident when you walk in to the room, and this work was the first work you saw in our exhibition in Los Angeles. And it's not, when you walk into this room, it's not clear what it is. You're not sure if it's a hole through the wall, or if it's something that's three-dimensional in front of the wall. And as you move, this cube moves with you. It has an incredible dynamic. Now, this is really James's first work of art. No painting, no drawing, just putting this projection into space. I could say, well, that has something to do with, you know, Los Angeles is big on productions, projections of light, like movies as well. But you said to me one time, you were talking about the fact that in art history class, we're always seeing projections of images. And you had this fundamental realization, well, why deal with the image? Why not just deal with the light itself, that physical thing? As you said, as an American, you're very direct. But of course, the light, that physicality of light, and this really feels physical. I think all of James's work has had to do with this idea that light can be something that you can hold and touch as we touch it with our eyes. You said in this short film, and I think it's so important, that we are part of making what we behold.
Yes, I don't know. I don't have this.
Are we on here?
I'm not. Oh, here I am. Okay. Thank you. And, you know, I first saw art projected. I mean, basically, on the West Coast, it hadn't formed then, the L.A. County Museum. We had the Pasadena Art Museum. And actually, the director of that and it is here today, but he was also my, Jim Dimitrian was also my teacher at Pomona College. People forget how important teachers and people that you meet, they're just doing their job as a teacher, but these are the things that actually can inspire you. And so that was very important. And I saw art history projected. And so the Mona Lisa was the same size as a Barnett Newman. Filled the screen. And also had this luminous quality because of the beaded glass screen. And so it was strange. When I saw the actual works later in my life, sometimes it was surprising how small they were and also how dull they were. But I had seen them in this projected fashion. So I started out as an artist. I was very interested in light. And then I remember that connecting with my grandmother, who was this conservative Wilburite Quaker who always talked about going inside to greet the light in meditation and how there is light in everyone. And so this idea of light was important to me. And lo and behold, the history of art is littered with depictions of light. And we can start anywhere you like to start, whether it's, you know, with Rembrandt or Caravaggio or Vermeer. Turner, how about Turner, someone so prescient in terms of what was to come later, then all the Impressionists, of course, and then Rothko. And I remember the making of this show that had Lichtenstein and Rothko in the show and how the light came out of this painting. It wasn't something that, I mean, it did contain it. It was something that it emanated, and I... some of these qualities are actually rather small when you describe them. It's like I remember just putting light onto a wall, and the fact is when you had a shape, it couldn't be seen as being on the wall. It was either slightly in front of it or sort of holed through it. So this quality was magical, that it was something very plastic or manipulative. You could actually use light to create space. And so this idea of... using light to create space was something marvelous to me. And you probably know that if you're on stage and you have all the stage light, the footlights and the stage lighting on you, sometimes there's so much light you can't see the audience. So you're in the same architectural, physical space as the audience, but a completely different visual space. No different than when the light of the sun lights the atmosphere, you can't see through the atmosphere to see the stars that are there. So actually, light is a space maker, and this idea that I could actually use it even close to people to actually control where you saw and didn't see, and how this transparency and opacity was. Those were these wonderful things. Now, this is not big news, but this is something that thrilled me as an artist to work with. And so it's these small things that in the end we work with. And it began in this classroom looking at projected images, and so I started out with projections.
And many people say, well, what's your medium? And you know, you do things that are painterly with color, but you're not a painter. You make objects, but you're not really a sculptor. You've made architecture in buildings, but you wouldn't necessarily call yourself an architect. And so when described, yes, light is part of your medium.
Yes.
But also, the most important part of your medium for me and what I've learned is this idea about perception, that quotation that we take for granted, this idea that we see something, we all see it the same way, or it's there objectively. And the one thing I've learned, and I see every time I am at Roden Crater or in one of your works, and then you deconstruct why I felt or saw that, it's because half of it was me contributing, putting things in.
Projecting
myself, my expectations. Yes. Color. We have works in color at LACMA that are immersive, that this one is on view now. It's called Breathing Light, and it is a work, when you first encounter it and it's outside this space, it appears to be a painting on the wall that's physical, like a rectangle in color. The color starts changing, which is a little strange, but it feels like a flat plane. There are stairs up to it, and like Alice in the Looking Glass, you actually then walk through this plane of light that seems physical to break the plane, and then you're immersed in light, and then you walk toward the light, and this light seems to be infinite, or if not infinite, you are absolutely unsure about where it begins and ends, and the color keeps changing, breathing, it's called Breathing Light. And it took me a while, and then you turn backwards to look through the aperture from whence you came, which is a room of white light, and yet that aperture is green, or blue, or orange, or all of these range of colors, and it defies understanding, because if I poke my head back through that wall, it's white again. And you come up with this incredible realization that the color I'm seeing, perceiving, is in me. I'm the one who must have created that environment by being, in pink light, and so therefore I see green. And it's such a fundamental realization for me, because it doesn't just apply to aesthetics or to color, it does, or in art history, but it also applies to everything. It means everything, whether it's history or people or reading or things I come upon, that I have to recognize that the context is everything and that I am contributing to this seeing. And it has something about this, you know, Roden Crater is a huge monument, but it's a monument to the fragility of perception. And I guess you kind of also started right there with psychology, right? That you knew that going into art.
Well, I took painting classes at Pomona College, and when you mix blue with yellow, you get green. But if you're wanting to work with light and you mix blue light and yellow light, you're going to get white light. So this is a shock, and something that a lot of people don't expect. And so the big thing is you have to learn the spectrum, because it's a whole different way of thinking. And so I actually had to learn about perception, how we perceive particularly light, as opposed to how we mix paint. So the color wheel is gone, and now you're involved in relationships that are quite different and have to do with how we perceive the spectrum and how that comes to us. And then, of course, there are these monuments to people discovering this idea of seeing. First of all, when Daguerre wanted to fix the image, he did so with mercury onto a silver plate and was able to actually make the daguerreotype. But he got subverted and became very successful as a photographer. But remember, he originally had been a painter of dioramas, where you would come up from beneath, and there would be this painting. And they often put these paintings in these great expositions. And one in Paris, he had this scene of this Alpine Swiss village, and you came up and you saw it during the day, and then light was put on the back of the canvases, and of course the clouds were heavily painted, so they became dark. There were little windows in the chalets and all, and so this is a painting that was actually, you know, it was an installation. So installation painting, he was doing this, but of course he then got subverted by becoming a successful photographer and never did any more of that again. So this is a revisionist history that I'm giving you of how this came out of the diorama, how it came out of the camera obscura, and also another thing in terms of light was Edwin Land, because he was actually a researcher and he was actually dealing with color vision. Now this is where the true ideas of color theory should go, and he's the one most expressive of this. And of course he dealt with green and red, or green and blue-green and red, and that's how he made the Polaroid. Of course, he was subverted and became successful, and that never did any more research in color vision. So what happens is that we all start out with these ideals, and some of them had amazing tracks to follow. And certainly with color vision, it was Land, and certainly with the diorama and the certainly the the big sort of installation kind of paintings,
cycloramas too.
Cycloramas, things like that, and by Meg in Holland is still there. A few of these still exist, so they're quite interesting kind of anomalies in the history of art.
So you have this idea of the light out there. You do deal with nature even inside, because this is a little like being in a whiteout or being in a cloud or being these spaces which are indeterminate, and then you have a different kind of emotion from that. Before we go outside to the landscape, just to go inside, another work, that work of art, Breathing Light, is on view in Los Angeles right now. In 1968 in Los Angeles, you were invited as part of LACMA's Art and Technology Project with Robert Irwin, another artist who identified you, and a scientist, Ed Wertz, and you discussed not art, but perception and how we see and feel. And I know there were a number of experiments at that time about even sensory deprivation and what happens when I'm put in different environments over time. This is a work of art that is in LACMA, at LACMA right now in Los Angeles. And it looks a little like a sphere or a spaceship or something like that. There's a computer, and what you're not seeing is if you go to LACMA and you make a reservation, you're greeted by some attendants in white lab coats. You take off your jacket and your shoes, and you lie down on a bed, and you are rolled inside the sphere. for one program for about 11 minutes. And I actually do this regularly. I enjoy it. It calms me down for a board meeting or anything important I have to do. It actually does calm you down. The longer programs are hard to stay awake in because it's so calming. And what happens is you're lying down and you're in a Ganzfeld, this is one of these spaces which is of indeterminate depth. And color and strobing color is introduced. And all of a sudden, not only are you pretty sure you're seeing colors that aren't there, but then you start seeing shapes, geometries, like geometric painting, architecture, beehives, rain, and you're not sure where it's coming from. Now, there's nothing inside the sphere except nothing. It's just empty. And the light has created that. But the truth is that you, the viewer, I am creating it from within. So this is an art, a kind of geometry, abstract painting that is created from within, that it is my eyes and my seeing. I think you once talked about it, you talk about it as a seeing from behind the eye seeing. Yeah. If you know a little the history of art, Renaissance painters always saw the painting as a window, right? It's a fake window, and then you can see through into nature or space, a fake three-dimensional depth. And then in the modernists said, oh, no, that's sort of illusion. We don't want to deal with illusion. We're going to make a painting that's just paint, really flat, right in front of you, right to the point. And I think the last thing to do with that picture plane of painting is sort of to put it only one place to go is behind the eyes. And when I was in this, I realized you had achieved that. But again, it's a phenomenon that I realize all of a sudden. I am making these colors, I am making these forms, and there is a quality to it of kind of intense relaxation. I had a friend who went in who's an insomniac, incredible insomniac. He said he slept for 2 weeks after, easily, after being in this chamber. And I'm not sure I know how it works, but I know it comes from that early research and thinking about, you know, experience.
Well, in art history, you talk a lot about the picture plane, which we would discuss, and I would like things that would take place. You know, I use the structured environment as Plato's cave. And so there are images that are kind of in some way reflective of our reality. Of course, we would look at them in the cave as upside down and backwards, but that's how we get them in the retina. And so this idea that Plato was talking about in Book 7 of the Republic is something that is reflected in art, both with this picture plane that's out there and that we actually can see through, or things are behind the picture plane. And here I have work that comes in front of the picture plane. And then I even would cut through the walls, cut through the ceiling, and have that still be this picture plane, bring the sky down to the space that you're in. But then eventually just take that picture plane and pull it over your head, as in the like a T-shirt, which I also have to say is a little bit of what we do as a planet when we start to reduce the ozone layer, and that makes these holes, and then eventually, you know, you can lose this whole atmosphere and it just becomes the rings, which is something we'd like not to do.
if possible, we're
now thinking about, yes. But this idea of taking this picture plane and really putting it so you're it's all taking place in your head. It's not actually out. None of this that you see, the geometry or even most of the color, is not out there at all in that sphere. It's actually inside your head. So,
yeah, it's funny because some people would wonder, is it the sculpture I'm seeing? What is it as an artwork? And yet it functions as a great artwork should, because it causes you to think. It is immersive. It's emotional. And you actually have images that you see. This interiority is really interesting. And what's also interesting about it is this is artwork that can be experienced only by one person alone over 11 minutes. And one of the curious things to me about your practice is that you've run the gamut. So you have this piece for one person, and then recently you made a huge work in the Guggenheim, which was the most well-attended exhibition, I think, ever in the Guggenheim's history, a work where you took Frank Lloyd Wright's building and introduced colored light into that space where people were literally lying on the ground, waiting in lines around the block. So it's interesting, this range of expression from the singular experience to a collective experience, and I think you've played with both. I want to go to, I know David's arriving soon. Oh, he's here? Where is he? Oh. David, get over there. We just got to the architecture component. So, David, I'm here.
Andrew. Okay. How are you?
Where do I sit?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
You said we were going to talk about you.
Perfect timing.
If you
hadn't actually started, but we actually worked on a project very early on, some time ago, in Siwa. That's an oasis in Egypt, but it's the oasis where Alexander the Great had his epiphany, and he was going to then leave and take over the world, and in fact, David has. and I see your work all over. I've been in Russia. I see it here. See it everywhere I've been going, and it's marvelous to see that.
You can comment on Jay. I'll show a couple of images here just of a project you wouldn't otherwise or easily be able to visit just before we get to Roden Crater. James is always out in the world in these strange places experimenting and doing things that then come back, I think, to this huge project, Roden Crater, the hard thing. This is a pyramid. It's an ellipsoid pyramid, and you saw the jungle around it. This is in the jungle of the Yucatan. in Mexico, not far.
It's like bringing coals to Newcastle. do they need another pyramid?
Well, you were playing with the notion of the pyramid, and it's worth saying the stonemasons were Mayan. There were Maya stonemasons that worked on this, the culture that's very much alive in the Yucatan, not gone at all, and very much in dialogue with art of the present. And I think there's that wonderful dialogue that the workers and even everyone had about the, you know, the old style pyramid and the new style pyramid made very differently in an ellipse, but in multi tiers.
Well, wait, at the bottom of Uxmal, that's an ellipse, and it goes up to a rectangle on top at the two foci of the ellipse. So they did, and they made elliptical pyramids. The mound builders made elliptical pyramids up the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
So it's a form that they use, and the bottom of this is the same size as the bottom at Uxmal.
In Uxmal, which is in relation to that. In fact, I was there when we were scouting the site, and it's over a cenote, which is a natural geologic formation, like a bubble in the stone, which then is filled with water, which were sacred sites for the Maya, and they provided the livelihood for communities in terms of water and also ritual. And then what this piece is a pyramid, and it I think a little bit deals with the creation myth of the chaos and order, but there's a tunnel that actually takes you from underneath the plane of the ground, up through the plane of the ground, and then to the sky, James, you've placed water. So it's water below and water above on the top of the pyramid once you've broken through. And like the ancient pyramids, your top is just above the tree line, because what's true in the Yucatan is that the trees only grow to a certain height because of the natural geology. And so all those pyramids were to get up to the sky. Which you have done here. It's very flat there. As you said, it's actually flatter than a pancake in the Yucatan. And this work is a mini pyramid that takes you from underneath. Okay, well, I thought we had another slide of the interior. But you can see its relationship to this found pyramid. This would be hard to build at full scale, as David would know. He might be able to figure it out, but I don't know about the budget for the building of this. And so, as you've often said, in this case, you found this in nature, and then you've adjusted it with the tunnels and the chambers, and you searched with your Guggenheim Fellowship. This is when you crisscrossed the Western United States looking for a bowl held up
in the sky.
In the sky.
Yes.
Which is, and maybe that originary moment of why Roden crater, why a crater? Because everybody says, why in the world would you?
Well, it's like having a pyramid
for an artwork.
You just have to put the tunnels and chambers in it. So I didn't have a pharaoh to build a pyramid. So we just took God's work. that was good enough.
So it sits in the Painted Desert. This is, it's unfinished still, as you said, your unfinished dissertation. And I think this embodies, when the inspiration for this conference, the plaque on Obama's desk that just said, hard things are hard. And I think both of you would attest to that, it's a public project.
Bigger than a bread box, and you certainly have done that.
Whether, David, for you, it's a public project in an urban environment with so many constraints, including tiny budgets, that take a long time, or James, to be out in the desert, creating something that was initially an idea that you had in the 60s, when right here, our President John F. Kennedy was saying, we're going to send a man to the moon. And I would think you were thinking, well, it would be a lot cheaper and easier to bring the moon and the cosmos down to Earth. And in some way, I see this Roden crater as a very inexpensive space program, where, since most of us won't do that, you can see the sun, and I have seen the sun projected through this tunnel onto this stone so that you can touch the sun. Now, that's a really amazing idea. And the sun ends up being about my size. So I have this sense that, you know, here I am communing with this celestial object, and you've made these sculptures. You don't see it projected there, but It's both in marble as that. This is the tunnel, which is over 800 feet long, that brings the image down, as well as provides a way to bring you up into the bowl of the crater. It's almost like a refractor, the world's biggest refractor telescope, although it's not for scientific study, it's for emotional and perceptual study. And these tunnels, and this is the main tunnel, just to give you an image, and then you walk up this tunnel, as it were, toward the light. And there is a staircase, which is a staircase to the heavens, indeed. But it also, this golden colored staircase, bronze, actually brings the light into the space. And as you go up that tunnel, this is the most incredible phenomena. You're looking at a circle the entire way up the tunnel. You're staring at a circle like an orb, like the sun. And as you walk into the space, you realize that that is not a circle at all. It's this very elongated ellipse. So again, I've been completely fooled, if you will. But then, of course, I realize a circle is nothing but an ellipse with the foci aligned. I've been taken through this simple math exercise, but in a way that's very emotional. And these holes cut in the ceilings, these sky spaces, have the effect, a day or night, of bringing the sky literally close enough to touch. Certain artists are famous for painting skies on ceilings, and I guess this is a very direct way of bringing the sky to a space where I can feel it in my own space in a physical way. And then here is the bowl of the crater, which creates a phenomena that I think, James, that you began with, this idea of celestial vaulting.
Vaulting,
that
yes.
If I'm in a space, the near space, like the color, if I'm in a green space, I look the other way, it will appear red. What's also true is if my space is curved in a certain way, it changes the curvature of what's experienced in that frame. So what James has done here in a very modest way, architecture, is change the shape of the sky, as well as change the color of the sky. And I think that's a pretty good architectural trick, especially given the history of domes and, you know, forming yes. things like marble and stone and wood to create those forms. And this is the scent, the eye, where you lie down within it. And of course, there are as many events that happen in the skies during the night as the day. And so this is a project that's intended as a place for you to stay. You can come just for the day, but you can also come for the evening events. And someday soon.
Yes, well.
It'll be.
And these things do get practiced in other places, like I did this show at the garage in Moscow. There, then went to see your building there, which was terrific, because everywhere I go, he's been there before.
Come on, James.
Anyway, so, but that was something to do that. Then after we did this at the garage, we brought this back, yeah. And you had the one. And of course, they completely wiped the program out of the computer for the. Yes. So, they do. The Russians do kind of deal with us in terms of the computer issues here, and they have recently in this election. So.
It is an interesting blend of where technology does affect that. I want to get to a conversation between two of you together and some. Commonalities that I actually see in some of your work, but as a way towards that, David, now that you're here, I'd like to talk about a couple of your projects. Do we have? Oh, I see. That's the wrong button. Oh, okay. There is the sky space at the center of Roden Crater, and at night, where the land does meet the sky. And there's a drawing of the unfinished space that does feel like an eyeball. It's like a cross-section through an eyeball looking at the sky. And maybe we can...
There we go.
So back to Washington, D.C. If you have not visited just very nearby, you may have already visited the big museum, very nearby are two libraries. Done with public budgets, very small budgets. This is the William O. Lockridge Bellevue Library, again, not far from here. And it's an extraordinary thing done on a very slim budget. It's When I go into these spaces of yours, I always feel like when I come out, that was a really big building because I had so many experiences. And then you look back and you realize it's not a very big building. But you immediately sense when you're in this neighborhood how this building relates to the houses around. I did introduce your work and your interest in social space, in thinking about people as much as architecture. And both formally, these things look like porches that are built out of a neighborhood where there are quite a few hills. And of course, the houses all around have exactly the same form. So it's immediately evident that you have used the context of the neighborhood to create a form outside that is instantly recognizable and I think therefore comfortable. And then you go inside this space, and again, it's a little bit Alice in Wonderland because it all of a sudden, well, here's the moving up to it. It's other worlds inside that seem to expand and expand. Here and your use of color, by the way, I don't know if you were taking notes from James Turrell's projections, but you often use color to paint spaces so that they have an atmosphere like a cloud, right?
No, I mean, James is a huge inspiration.
He's not afraid of color, which is great.
No, James is a huge inspiration. As a sort of young student, I was studying all of James's work.
Well, the big thing is that sometimes you might remember playing a symphony or something. You can be in a very small apartment room, and you can play music, and suddenly the space is enlarged. And you're actually in a larger space than you were before the music was on. And so David has made spaces where, literally, bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. It's like that car that they have at the circus where 26 people get out of the car. And so this quality of the built environment having references to the world we really live in, as opposed to just this rationalized, what we call the rational environment, where architecture adds space, makes things larger, makes your life, sort of enlarges your life, is something that he's been very much involved in, and I've admired that greatly.
Yeah, and these, it's not just even the sense of space, it's a sense of journey. There are spaces, there are nooks and crannies, there's a place where you feel like you can lie down next to the books or curl up. And I think there's one, I remember the one near the children's section where kids can curl up with a book. Of course, there's an adult there curled up with a book. So also this wonder of kids' spaces. We talked about in New York, the Children's Museum of Art and Storytelling. So just say something. You've actually, I think some of your most amazing work has been in this form of libraries, which some people say, oh, they're outmoded. We're all books are through Amazon or it's going to be on the internet. And yet you've doubled down on the idea of the library as public space, social space, and that's your own interest.
Yeah, no, I think that the idea of knowledge centers and the idea of public libraries, which is really, the 20th century is when the U.S. really embraced them. You know, post-war, there was this kind of building of a kind of infrastructure all over the country to allow people to gain knowledge. But this, I think that what it does is that it creates within a community a collective space, a collective sharing space where different generations come together to see each other and gather. And that, I think, is a very important, even though technology shifts the kind of content of that, I think that the residue of that in our bodies as a place that we go to is very important. And I think that this idea that there are these types of spaces that we come together and enjoy information, it doesn't matter if the technology shifted, but they become these spaces where we come together, are important types that we need to remember, especially as the world is changing. So for me, the library is not lost. The library is just to be remade.
Yeah.
It needs to be remade, and it needs to become another environment for a new generation, which sees itself in a new way. You know, it's not about going along lots of kind of academic files. It's about sharing information, sharing technology. It's about watching technology evolve as it disappears, literally. You know, 5 years throughout making the library, we were sort of at the advent of Wi-Fi and soft sort of the ability to kind of have a kind of completely sort of what I call a soft environment, not hard wires everywhere. And so we were already designing a building which had to kind of think about that, where, you know, so it was already evolving. So, but what it does is I think it brings architecture much, much more back to its primary purpose, which I think is this idea of a kind of understanding of where you are, a way of making a sensation of place, a way of being able to understand the world, still not just the world as a kind of large phenomenon, but the world specifically where you are. And I think light is like one of the powerful mediums. So for me, color and light are the same thing. When I use color, I'm really talking about light. I'm not talking about color as a symbolism, but as a kind of light.
Yeah. Well, and you've often used, I mean, one of your techniques always is to somehow using darkness to frame that light and to intensify it. There are buildings you've made in London that I've seen, there are houses where they're dark and you've used darkness to really enhance light. I mean, even this museum has that quality of using a bit of darkness to turn the volume up on that light and experience. But one of the things about these libraries is that, you know, you think about the library is to receive knowledge and this universe, but when I'm in your libraries, it's sort of like all that is there because that's the world of possibilities. And I think they are often as inspiring as places to absorb knowledge is actually think there and dream of what you might do to contribute to that knowledge or to life. And I think there's an interesting reversal in public space. Museums, I think the best museums do that same thing. All that knowledge is really not like required reading because you have to know it. It's a world of possibilities like that library. And I mean, I had 100 ideas when I was sitting in your library of other things to do, I think, because it is inspirational in that way. And I guess you continue that idea of social space. In these neighborhoods, it seems to me that these are now social centers, right? Almost like town squares?
Correct.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, the big thing is that we are these strange crustaceans. We make these forms that we inhabit, and almost like a hermit crab, then we now will leave this shell here, go get in a movable shell, and get out in another one, trying to keep from...
That's a beautiful description.
And so these shells we put around us. And so they're more than just the form and the monument of the architecture. They are what these shells do, how they open out onto other possibilities, and what they contain and what they help us with. And so I think that the idea that there is a community that inhabits these things is important, because you can go and see buildings that are empty, have been emptied of use, and often they look dead because there's no consciousness that inhabits them. And so conjuring up this consciousness and what it can do and what its possibilities are is really the job of the architect, which is amazing to be able to do that, because it has a lot to do with people and those who actually, with consciousness, inhabit these structures.
You, David, this is the other Francis A. Gregory Neighborhood Library, and I think to Jim's point and also the slides we showed of Roden Crater, one of the things you're so good at is taking the shell and puncturing it.
Yes.
Like this, and creating permeable membranes, whether through mirrors, glass, openings, to the outside. Say something about that idea of the permeability. I think it's like one of the most important aspects of your work.
Thank you. I mean, I sort of became very disillusioned with the idea of the window just as a kind of device to bring light in, or a glass wall as the device, because I think that, yes, practically that makes sense, but actually emotionally in our deep subconscious, I think the idea of light really is about the way in which it's filtered and it's sort of, you know, so I think back, I kind of imagine the sort of perception of light from a forest or from a hilltop or from a cave looking out. So for me, I think that we're deeply hardwired with this emotion, and I'm interested very much in allowing architecture to reach back to that emotion. Mm-hmm. So for me, when I'm making a piece of architecture, I'm thinking about how that perforation evokes an emotion, mm-hmm. and how, for me, the window kind of denotes the kind of 500 years of architectural history, and I'm trying to go further back. I'm interested in going
back,
further back.
To a more ancient sense of,
exactly.
of permeability between inside and outside. Before air conditioning.
Before air conditioning, before the seal box.
Which seems to be always the issue of sealing us in.
Yes.
And this notion of community. James was talking about, you know, space has to be inhabited by a consciousness, by people. This is in Moscow, and it's one of your most ambitious projects. I mean, it is a crazy, crazy project. And it's a school, it's Moscow School of Management. But really, it's to inspire, I think, young and old to, in a community, this is in a very derelict part of town, and to revitalize itself through education and economics, to have kids become interested in also technology and business to create a sustainable world. Yeah. It's on a university scale. So this is talking about scale. You're a city builder here. Do you think
small
that way? Big ideas?
I'm really obsessed with ideas and not scale. I try not to think about scale, right, James? I mean, I try not to, because I think if I started to think of it as the idea of the city or the idea of the object, I think that sort of collapses your creativity. Right. So for me, it's just the kind of the issue of the idea. And this was about a couple of things. One, it was to create something inspirational for, you know, sort of management class, and not to feel disempowered by a kind of history that immediately was, I mean, I think that sort of early 20th century history, which is where, you know, that modernist idea came from, really, that sort of constructivist idea really comes from Russia, right? But that history is completely lost. And, you know, I mean, if you go to most, you know, the classical world has kind of taken back that idea. And none of these buildings or these ideas that were kind of dreamt of 100 years ago were kind of brought to fruition. Very few kind of models were tested. So I was really fascinated by this idea that one should make one of those dreams, which was the idea of a building that defies gravity, mm-hmm. but is a city, a building like a city. So it's not just a single building, but it's a hybrid building, which all the parts from what I call the mind and the body are at play. So it's a building about respite. It's about, you know, exercise. It's about, you know, looking after your body. But it's also about the mind. It's about sort of almost these monastic walks that kind of meander through this complex that allow you to meditate and meet other people and engage. But also then these sort of agoras, these kind of sort of spaces that are the digital teaching spaces about the world that you live in. So it's, I mean, it's this, and then the idea of the image of the building is really, again, back to light.
Yes, but because it's also something that has just immediately gentrified an area. I mean, that's completely, completely restored
and put there.
There was nothing there.
It put the dream into this area.
It created something out of nothing, which is really astounding in that way, that it's also created a economy. And there's this notion that architecture can change the world, I think, in as art can, in really material ways, because it can change the way people think, as well as be physical in creating spaces for people to interact, to learn. I mean, this is your most recent monument. I feel lucky as a visitor. And as I said earlier, as someone who grew up around here, to have you have been selected as the architect for this building, which I knew would have so many amazing aspects to it. And it is a monument. It sits in relation to monuments. Mm-hmm. It plays with the idea of monument, I think, in a very playful way. And it's not only, I think, about transformation of society, the struggle, pain, celebration, but it is also, I think, again, intended to continue to transform society in some way, in ways that are unpredictable, by inspiring those who visit to see new histories, see different histories. I was overhearing last night conversations in front of objects and people talking about, well, I didn't exactly learn that in school, or I learned that in a different way, and that makes me think differently already. And again, how you frame light in it is super inspirational. I think the change is yet to come of what this building will hopefully inspire. There are a few James Turrell moments in it, I have to say. Contemplative court is very James Turrell. And very lessons well internalized.
I really believe that, you know, art and architecture is about learning from things that are done. I mean, not copying, but learning from. So I'm very conscious of that. I think that it's foolhardy to sort of pretend that there isn't a history and an incredible body of knowledge that's being kind of formed. So, you know, I think James is...
But the other thing that's so strong is this inside to outside.
Yeah.
And this lacy transparency and looking very physical and then being almost...
Dissolving.
Dissolving, evaporative. I mean, that's why I find it Very strong.
Great. Thank you, sir.
And so that's a great strength.
That means a lot. I mean, there's a little emotional moment.
You know, there's a point here about that, too, that is that, you know, we've talked a lot about imagination and images and even touching on illusion and all these effects that happen. But I think we shouldn't forget that even, James, in your explorations of perception, then that affects my daily life. I don't lose the experience of your work when I'm in this world because it has changed the way I see the real world. And David, there was a quote that I saw that, you know, a museum or architecture could be something that, like a cinema, you would go in and then have that experience and go out. But I think what's true about these experiments with perception, they're not just aesthetic, and your museum is not. And you say, you know, because the experience of being black is not a fiction. There's something important about always coming back to the light of day. And I think that is a wonderful way you've used a formal element, light, mm-hmm. James, you have in perception, to create a change in a concrete reality. And I think that is very intentional.
Very intentional, yeah.
The one thing I notice about that, and it's something I'm tying these two very disparate things together, you both also are always looking at other achievements, other cultures, other places. You know, that building is inspired by a Yoruba pedestal, it's like a pedestal, like that inverted ziggurat form that we know from that art and architecture. I see so many references to other cultures. When I'm walking on Roden Crater, I'm seeing references to the Hopi. I'm seeing, you know, bits of Buddhism. I'm seeing European tradition. And I'm curious about your thinking about that as artists, architects, about building upon other civilizations, cultures, other ideas. Seems like you both
knew
that.
When I was young, I thought that we were building a culture.
Yeah, one human culture.
Human culture. Of course, we can't even have, you know, there's not even a political party with a plank that has to do with culture or art or architecture. So I'm glad I'm not a single issue voter. But because my issues haven't been taken care of. But I think it's, you know, this is the big thing that we all thought that we were about. And that is happening, even though it may be disregarded in some of our social things right now. But it's something that artists, architects are really paying attention to, certainly in music and as well. So this is forming. Yeah. And that it forms that way is natural and exciting.
So this
and I think that, you know, watching this happen in architecture is amazing. And if you think of how we lived, just think how we lived 40 years ago, how we ate, the food we ate. Boy, we've raised the bar on food and restaurants and eating. And just drive a car from 40 years ago, and it drives like a truck compared to a car today. I mean, the cars will accelerate faster, brake faster, have more comfortable seats, and a better radio. So just whether it's art,
making
architecture, we have been raising the bar. Everyone thinks that things are going downhill. But, you know, we have really raised the bar throughout the culture. And, boy, tolerance has changed.
Yeah, I think
I have to say that this is one of the biggest things that I've ever felt. And this changing of tolerance. Yes.
Is changing, I think. That's right. And this is these big ideas. You know, this was inspired, this whole conference, by, I think, trying to inspire others to have big ideas and not to feel that the system is something that is working against us and you can't create those things. And James, you've done that, you know, working four decades plus on almost fifth decade and Roden Crater and things that are you can persist with. And David, you've done that again. I mean, you've also come all the way from Ghana to to get here to talk to us about this.
They wouldn't let him through the wall, though. He was stopped at customs.
You guys are poster children for persistence.
I had to brag. To brag to the customs officer that I did this building down the road.
You're due at the White House.
I need
so
to kind of run.
You guys are that. You're poster children for this persistence, too. And James, we talked a little about, you know, in those 60s, you could do anything. You could send a man in the moon. But David, you, just to maybe end, you grew up in a very different environment,
sure,
from a different place of the world, with different experiences in a completely different generation. Mm-hmm. And yet you've pursued your vision to this museum, a huge idea. You know, Can you convey that inspiration, that sense of possibility to others? I mean, you've done it here in your
pressure.
Work.
I just think that we live in an age where it's incredibly, I mean, there is just so much, there's so many roots, I think, now. There's so many, it used to feel like a world where it was a kind of singular root, yeah. Not many kind of branches. And I think there are now, I think what is possible is that there are so many ways to contribute to culture and society and to the world that we kind of believe in. And I think that what I find inspiring about the time we live in is that there are these incredible possibilities. So I don't see limits. I mean, I know there are so many limits,
yeah.
But I see with those limits incredible opportunities all the time. Because I think as things collapse, then things can also be changed. I mean, as things kind of close down, things also open up. So I'm very much interested in this dialectic. And so when people think things are finished, I'm always interested in saying, oh, well, that means that we're opening something else. Yeah.
Right.
So I'm sort of, maybe I'm an eternal romantic optimist, but that's what drives my my creativity and also my belief in not also seeing, you know, like we were even talking about, things from the past that, you know, the past isn't finished, it's continuous. Mm-hmm. So, you know, referring to Egypt or to the Mayans or to the Buddhists or it's still all real for me. It's much more Einsteinian. It's much more a kind of Einstein sense of time rather than a sort of progression of time. It's all happening and we should understand what we need from each thing and use it to help the times that we're in.
Yeah, I think something that's exactly right. And I think also just something you share is that there's a sense of locality, of specifics, down to the materials you both use, or the land, or the references, the bronze, and how you use that in terms of historical references, but also localities. And also, there is taking from other times and places. And I guess that's also a signal. It's like hard things are hard. There is also no black and white rules about localism versus globalism.
No.
There's no simple answer.
No.
There's a combination of things, and we must be mobile enough to accept these other influences, build things locally. And I know both of you have done that so beautifully. And I know that the rest of the president's program is going to continue soon. And I think we have the mayor here. So I just want to say an incredible thank you to both of you for the hard things and the big things you are contributing to our world every day.
Thank you.
And thank you both for taking the time. We have, so I think we have some closing remarks. Yeah, so I just want to say that, and I think we have our, do we have our mayor here? Yeah. Oh, she's coming right here. Okay. Well, in the meantime, before the mayor is here to close this last question then, I'm going to ask you the audience question since I know we don't have time for that. Talk a little about localism, globalism. Like here, the mayor of D.C. is going to be here. There's an urgent community needs, and you've made things locally, but then you do reach out to the world and take influences from everywhere.
I mean, I would even say local and planetary. I would say specific and plan. I prefer the word planet than global, because global kind of for me is economic and somehow abstract.
Well, I'm waiting for this. I like to do a nice project in Olympus Mons on Mars.
that's
one of the bigger volcanoes.
Not enough. Sorry, I just closed it down. I'm
in
so sorry. I forgot we're in a solar system.
The heart
in the galaxy.
And big ideas. We are now going to include the cosmic.
Brilliant.
It's worth saying when just to go back to the Gonsfeld piece at Los Angeles. If you see it, James once described it to me as the new landscape. Because it has no horizon. And this was very meaningful to me in thinking about being immersed in this space. And he said, but we're already there between the cyberspace, where there's no horizon, and
no up, no down, no left, no right.
No up, no down, no left, no right. Or the fact that space travel is upon us, no up, no down, no left, no right. That's a basic assumption we live with every day about gravity and that horizon in front of us. And I think that idea that an artwork or architecture can constantly provoke that new thinking, which is what you both do. And we are very lucky, actually, to have for our closing remarks mayor of D.C., who I've seen once and seen speak, but mostly on television, and you are changing this locality. I know that you have incredible, you've been here since 2015 as mayor, Muriel Bowser, seventh elected mayor, and your focus on job training, on education, I think you have, and we should all help end homelessness. And I think that's been an amazing effort of yours. You are also extremely well-educated in public policy, and I think your focus on exploration of talent, education and talent is very relevant to this this session right now. So, Mayor Bowser, thank you for being here.
Well, good morning, everybody. I am very happy to be here in the beautiful museum and certainly delighted to be able to help close out this exciting panel. I want to acknowledge all our friends at the museum and certainly thank the organizers of the White House for partnering with us in Events DC to put on a fantastic South by South lawn. So I'm happy to help kick it off. And it's really hard for me to turn down an opportunity to talk about what we're doing in Washington, especially around innovation and ideas, and especially around making Washington, D.C. the hub for inclusive tech in the nation, right? That's good. That's good for Washington. I want to acknowledge my Deputy Mayor, Brian Kenner, and Brian will tell you that his job is to bring more revenue to the District of Columbia, create more jobs for Washingtonians, and to make sure we're investing in affordable housing across all eight wards of the district. We are very lucky to be a city that is growing, to be able to invest in our priorities, and to be able to focus on not only being a city for the 670,000 of us that live here right now, but plan and prepare for our future. And that's exactly what we're doing. So one thing about a city that adds net 1,000 people a month, they need great housing, and it should be beautiful. Right, David? Inspiring. And we need a lot of it, and it has to be affordable. Can you do that? And so that's why we are working. We are always encouraging people to think about the big problems of cities. We've thought about technology and art and innovation and all of that on some of our practical things like transportation, and we need that too. We also need you to focus your good ideas and action around the human services. You talk about how we're going to end homelessness. So when you're at South By and you're thinking about all of these ideas, think about transportation. Think about the more technology-focused solutions that we're familiar with, but also think about the human services and how we change things. I had the opportunity, and I was pretty proud of David on Saturday. I'm proud of him all the time, but I got the chance to meet him a few years back, and we're talking about our libraries and our schools in Washington, D.C., and now to have a building on the Mall is pretty incredible. And so our focus, and I think that you probably have had an opportunity to meet Angie Gates, who's responsible for film, television, and entertainment in the District of Columbia. And we want the word to get out far and wide that people come to Washington, D.C. in the arts and entertainment, and they can work here. We also want the people who are involved in those creative jobs to know that we want to build an ecosystem for people so that they can work and build their families here, and we're finally getting some notice around those ideas as well. Brian came to me last year and said, we're going to be the tech hub for the nation for underrepresented communities, and we're going to lay out the groundwork to get there. So I'm already excited that women in tech do very well in Washington, D.C. Women entrepreneurs, I think the second best. We're first best. I think we started out as second best, and now we are the best for women tech entrepreneurs, and that's important. Last year, we broke ground with Howard University, our partner, in creating a tech hub on Georgia Avenue, one of our corridors. And it will open imminently with Luma Labs, and we're very, very proud of that as well. So those are the important things that we're doing to build an inclusive tech hub in Washington, to focus on how people who are involved in the arts can see how they can link their work to action around, you know, different problems that we have in cities that they may not have even considered. And we, of course, want to make sure that we're working in partnership with our friends at the White House. And many of us are looking at the past 8 years and are very thankful for what President and Mrs. Obama have done with the city, and we can only hope that those partnerships continue. We know that there are going to be residents of Washington, D.C., not just of the White House, in a few months, and they will have the opportunity with me and 670,000 Washingtonians, not just to talk about the fabulous things that we can do together, but to also be in partnership with us was one of the big issues, one of the big injustices of our nation, and that is that 670,000 people who live here and pay a lot of taxes don't actually have a vote in the Congress, and that's one thing that we're focused on in D.C. So go back to your states, wherever you're from, tell them how fabulous our city is, but also tell them to focus on statehood for Washington, D.C. So enjoy South By. Let me thank the Events D.C. leadership and board for their support of this event. And when the White House calls you and asks you for some help, what do you say? Yes. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. And that's why we've been proud to host this event. I think it's going to be a party, too, right? And a party. So after you share all your good ideas on the lawn, join us this evening as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Bowser. Thank you, David Ajay. Thank you, James Terrell, for sharing your time and ambition and art and architecture. Thank you for just listening, but to hopefully contribute to this project, as James Terrell said, of making our culture. And I know this is an amazing a day of events to inspire new thinking. So thanks to the White House for that and for DC Events for hosting us. And thank you for being here. Have a great day.